Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics Live, Bruegel's podcast and event format that we are especially using in this period of tumult and crisis and war to discuss current developments and discuss the European strategy. And today we are very pleased to have Diederik Samson here joining us. He is the head of cabinet of the executive vice president Frans Timmermans of the European Commission, and therefore in a pivotal position to really look at and decide how Europe can make itself independent or more independent from Russian fossil fuels. So we want to hear about the EU strategy, Repower EU. And we want to discuss that strategy critically together with my colleague, Georg Zachmann, senior fellow at Bruegel. And without much further ado, let me just mention before I give the word to Diederik, let me mention there is scope for you in our audience to ask questions, give us remarks. Go on Slido and type in the code FUEL, F-U-E-L. And I'll be able to read that here on my machine and put those questions to our speakers. Without much further ado, Diederik, thank you so much for joining us today bringing us up to speed on where the EU is currently in making itself independent from Russian fossil fuels. I mean, we are still using a lot of it.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And indeed, that conclusion is the right one and a sobering one. We are way too over-dependent from one supplier of fossil fuels, Russia. And actually, we have been sleepwalking into that situation for the last three decades. And that should end. Some of us knew that earlier than others, but now all of us realize it due to the horrific circumstances that we are now in. And that means we have to step up to the plate and get ourselves independent from Russian fuel. And that discussion actually within the Commission started already earlier. Actually, it started at the beginning of this mandate where we launched the Green Deal and then translated that into the climate law and translated that into Fit for 55, because that's actually our overall program to get ourselves independent from fossil fuels, full stop, including the Russian ones. But obviously, this situation asks for a specific plan with specific, you could say, emphasis to accelerate parts of Fit for 55 in order to get our over dependency on Russian fuels as soon as we can. And those discussions started within the Commission at the beginning of last autumn, actually, because we already watched before actually Putin invaded Ukraine. We already had a specific problem. We went into last winter with way too little gas storage. And we actually saved by the fact that this was one of the mildest winters in a few decades, if you look at Europe overall. I can now frankly say that if we had a minus 10 winter for, let's say, a month in February, we would have been in huge trouble. And we already, before Putin started his war, we wanted to make a plan to prevent that for next winter. And that plan looks a lot like the plan that we have now on the table, which is even more urgent, which is called Repower EU. Get ourselves independent from Russian fossil fuels, and more specifically, get rid of 66%, two-thirds of the gas imports from Russia by next winter. And that's actually our main focus at the moment. You could say it's a bit narrow because it's only focusing on gas. Meanwhile, we're working on coal, which is, you could say, the easy part, because coal you can get from all over the world. But also oil, which is, you could argue, just as difficult as gas. And so there's still a lot of work to do also by the Commission. And we take profit from the work that your think tank is doing, advising or hinting, suggesting us how to move forward.
Wonderful. Thanks, Diederik, for this first kickoff. And of course, I also want to get Georg at some stage. But before that, can you perhaps give us some more details on how we really want to go down on the gas, Russian gas, by two-thirds? I mean, that's a huge decrease. On the other hand, and you know, there, let me also give immediately the criticism of this, is that this gradual reduction, I mean, it's a rapid but still gradual reduction compared to a full embargo stop, is of course also contributing to an increase in the price of gas, right? And by increasing the price of gas, the rent that Putin and his regime is gaining is actually increasing. So I guess I have these two questions. I mean, first, explain to us how we go down by two-thirds. Is that two-thirds for the EU as a whole? What about the more exposed countries in the East? And then in the second step, we discuss a bit what it means in terms of actual revenues that Vladimir Putin still makes on selling gas to us.
Yeah, well, let me start with the first question. We import 150 billion cubic meters of gas. I happen to notice that you calculate in terawatt hours, so you have to do everything by 10, multiply it by 10, but it's the same numbers, obviously. And so 150 billion cubic meters of gas is imported from Russia into Europe each year. That's 150 cubic kilometers. So if you want to sort of imagine how much that is, take walk a kilometer to forward, and then 1 kilometer to the left, and then 1 kilometer upwards, and that's the box that is filled with gas times 150. So that's what we import every year. So we need to get rid of 100 of that by the end of next winter, by the beginning of next winter. And the easy part, which has nothing to do with climate or diversification towards renewables or energy saving, is just getting the gas from somewhere else. And we can do that by contracting LNG from third countries like the US, like Japan, like Australia, like the Middle East, Northern Africa to a certain extent. And we think that if you calculate what happened in the first 2 months of this year, where we used the maximum capacity of our LNG terminals, to be extended over the next years, by the way, but this is the capacity we have, we can import 50 billion cubic meters of gas extra compared to normal years. So that's already half of the 100. That's quite a lot. But that's not enough. So we also have three pipelines that are not Russian coming to Europe, which is the Algerian one, the Norwegian one, and the Azerbaijani one. And we can ramp the imports from those pipelines up with 10 billion cubic meters of gas, brings us to 60. So 40 to go. And that's actually where the interesting part of the story starts, because then we're getting into Fit for 55, Green Deal, and climate policies, diversifying not by just taking the same molecule from somewhere else, natural gas from somewhere else, but really creating more renewables, creating more efficiency, diversifying to other gases, biomethane and hydrogen. Hydrogen won't play a big role next year. I mean, up to next winter, that's pie in the sky if you want to get to billions of cubic meters of gas. Obviously, hydrogen developments are going very fast at the moment, but they start from almost zero. But another story can be told about biomethane. We have a huge potential of biogas, turning that into biomethane with the same qualities as natural gas that we use in our houses. We can already get to 3.5 billion cubic meters by the end of next year. That program overall doubles the ambition on biomethane compared to the original Fit for 55 plans that we had. The original plans had 17 billion cubic meters of biomethane by 2030, which is quite a lot compared to what we have today. We want to double that. And with the current gas prices, actually, biomethane has an enormous business case, so it shouldn't be too difficult. Energy savings is obviously one of the ways to go. Could give you 14 billion cubic meters extra by next year if you ramp the current programs that we have already implementing, or that we are implementing at the moment, if you ramp them up, not double them, because that's not possible overnight, but with 20, 20% extra, you save 14 billion cubic meters of gas. And a similar story can be told about renewables. If you calculate, if you count what we put down in renewables every year, and the deployment of wind and solar last year saved us about 10 to 15 billion cubic meters of gas. If we increase that deployment over the next years, starting off with this year, obviously, we save ourselves 20 billion cubic meters of gas. So altogether, that's just above 100, and that's the first year. Obviously, after that first year, you can't do the trick of LNG every year again. 50 billion cubic meters is our maximum capacity. That's it. Same for the other pipelines. So you have to increase your efforts in efficiency and renewables. If you do that for 3 more years, we are out of Russian gas by 2026 or 2027. And that's only gas.
Okay, let me bring in Georg, and afterwards we talk about what it all means in terms of revenues for Putin. But Georg, please.
Yes, thanks a lot. Let me try to be very German and directly jump into the points that that I find sticky. I think the kind of the current plan is supposed to be kind of gradual phase out, a very speedy gradual, but gradual phase out. And as I see it, the situation we are confronted with is a situation where every day we are threatened with a supply disruption from Russia or from our own political system in order to do something in what is really an economic war. And we are now in an economic wartime. It is not a business as usual situation. It is kind of an emergency situation that requires to go beyond the kind of the usual approaches of a gradual roll out of more of the good stuff that we anyway planned. And the scenario, as I can see it, does not focus really on the imminent crisis as much as it focuses essentially on kind of slowly declining the amount of guys. But the problem is the imminent crisis is super dangerous because essentially if we do not manage to coordinate the imminent crisis well, important European institutions will fall apart. If we do not manage to find a way to have really a coordination for this imminent crisis, and it needs preparation. So we really need to start now to prepare for the crisis in 2021, 2022, and not for the potential risks in 2024, 2025. We have the risk on the single market, and this is already starting with Spain and Portugal partly decoupling from the European market. We have the risk on the integrity of the ETS, and ultimately we have the risk on the solidarity between member states in energy terms. And therefore, I fear that we still have too much focus on the midterm. And the question here is also, do we really want to cut Russia forever? I mean, it's kind of what's the point of sitting next to a neighbor that our plan is about entirely cutting off from it? I mean, that sounds very, very difficult also to pursue if they are offering us next year, the year after, and all the following years, always gas at a quarter of the price that we can get elsewhere. It will be very difficult to withstand the temptation. So we should better build institutions that allow us to buy in a safe and secure way what is good for us. Not only let certain European companies benefit from it, but let European citizens benefit from this. Now, on the potential on a few smaller items, on the incentives for filling gas storages. I'm not entirely sure, but what we have in place is actually going to work. It's still risking that member states are doing their own stuff. And I mean, we need to bring gas into the East now. We need to bring gas into Polish and Hungarian storages and maybe in Ukrainian storages, because we will not be able to supply Eastern Europe if gas is being cut and we only start sending them gas in after summer. The flow that we calculated that is needed there is a constant annual flow. If you cut it down, it's getting to be quite complicated. We still have European member states governments going to all those difficult supplier countries and competing. And I don't know what they are offering in the in backdoor meetings to them in terms of political or military assistance or things, but also in terms of economics, we are seeing that there's going to be an overbidding war. And the current approach to say we make a voluntary coordination of our buying efforts might not be able to ensure solidarity if it really comes to the diverse, so we should move faster on that.
Okay, Georg, let Dietrich perhaps reply to some of those points. These were already very meaty points. So Dietrich, please.
Well, I think the main point is, and George is completely right. The only way to really address this crisis that is indeed also imminent in terms of prices and indeed possible disruption. Both items are translated into the current volatility of the gas market. The only way to address that is as Europe as a whole, Europe as one. All the other attempts are just trying to tackle some symptoms, decoupling electricity prices from gas prices, as the Iberian Peninsula now wants, is actually asking companies to turn very expensive gas into very cheap electricity. There's nobody having a magic stick here. Capping gas prices only works if you can get that gas at the price cap. Otherwise, you spend billions or tens or even hundreds of billions of euros of taxpayers' money. So what we should do, and that's also what the Commission proposed to the Council, is joint purchasing of gas. So indeed, no longer going out there in the world as a country or as a company, out on your own, overbidding the other, trying to secure the last cubic meter of gas from Qatar or wherever, because that will lead to increased prices. And the only way to secure a moderate price is, well, basically you need two ingredients. You need to be a big buyer and you need to be in it for the long term. And Europe can do both. If we combine our demand, we are the biggest gas buyer in the world. And if we convince the partner countries, be it Qatar or be it the US, that we are in this for the long game, so not just for the next 5 years buying as much LNG as possible, but entering into a long-term partnership towards hydrogen development, which is especially relevant for Qatar, US, but especially for Northern Africa, we could enter into partnerships with third countries that are healthy, long-term, and deliver energy at moderate prices. Not the prices that we've seen 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, or even 2 years ago, because let's face it, those prices were too cheap.
Can I push you a little bit on the solidarity argument and the joint purchases? I mean, I, of course, being in Brussels and being a good European, I'm totally buying into that story. But I'm only buying into that story if at the same time you can guarantee me that there will be the internal solidarity in terms of gas supply. So put differently, what Georg mentioned, I mean, can we really be sure that the gas will be sent to Germany and to the East if the next winter comes and there are some shortages and, you know, we have to distribute and decide how to allocate this scarcity of gas? So I mean, yes, we can critique Robert Habeck for being in Qatar and, you know, striking a deal. But, you know, can he actually be sure that he would get Dutch gas, for example? Since you're Dutch, let me ask you directly in case he needs it more than the Dutch need it. I mean, so where do we stand on this internal solidarity argument?
We already started that discussion more than 13 years ago. This is not the first gas crisis that we have. 2009, we had a similar story, a similar situation. And in that situation, Europe already embarked onto regulations and arrangements for solidarity. We can strengthen those. I'm not even sure whether that's actually needed, because they are already in place. What is needed is obviously the perspective that there is at least some that there is at least enough gas for everyone, maybe with some demand curtailment, but not in crisis mode. I lost your picture, by the way. Are we still ill?
I'm here. I can see you also. Yes.
Well, then we do without pictures, no problem for me. No, so I think the best way forward is to, you're right, if these internal solidarity mechanisms need to be increased, they need to be increased and they will have to be increased. But internal solidarity to distribute or to share an enormous shortage is going to be much more difficult than internal solidarity to share sort of a supply that is meeting some of the demands. Maybe not all. I mean, I'm the first to go out there and tell the European population that we might prepare for being able to use less gas than we are comfortable with. Yes, that's the new situation.
Reduce the heating.
Yes. Well, that's one of the ideas that we put into REPowerEU, and maybe it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it was there as a serious proposal. If everybody puts the heat down with 1 degree, we save ourselves 10 billion cubic meters of gas in Europe.
No, but I think that's definitely what we have to do, just to also increase our strategic options vis-a-vis Putin and you know, save some gas and fill up the storages more quickly. But Georg, I want to bring you back into the discussion because you also have to leave at 11:30 sharp. So Georg, please add a few more points.
Yeah, no, I think this point of solidarity is the essential point. And one idea that I would like to test with you essentially is to which degree essentially the US could help us with this solidarity aspect. So I see that we have a kind of a pool of options that we have available in the different member states and that are not only market options, but some of them are non-market options. So in your country, we can ask population to accept seismic activity in any groaning field. In my country, Germany, we can ask a population to accept the prolongation of nuclear plants, kind of accepting that certain coal-fired power plants are brought back from the reserve, that lignite-fired power plants produce fully, that maybe some pollution limits are not applicable anymore to in order to be able to burn dirtier coal, to ask to the French to build an electricity crossing from Spain. So there is a lot of things that governments and political systems we would ask them for. Then there would be a lot in terms of gas joint procurement and where we kind of buy the gas and have to distribute it. So there's so many levels of distributional effects in that. And I wonder whether a joint approach with the US as a sort of honest broker that can bring in a lot of energy into the European system, but only does it if we manage to get our act together, could essentially help us to strike an internal political deal. Because then those that are not getting part of this European activity might then not benefit from the U.S. energy riches that they might bring over. So any thought on that would be appreciated.
You want me to respond to that? Yeah, Gunther.
Yes, please.
All right. Yes, well, the US is obviously a very important partner and you could call them an honest broker, although they also tell us that, yes, they are prepared to deliver 15 billion cubic meters of LNG already this year, running up to 30 at the end in a few years' time, but there is a cost to it, a price. So I wouldn't put all my eggs in only the US basket. We are looking at, also from a Green Deal perspective, also from a forward-looking perspective, we are looking at North Africa with more interest than average, because we think that Northern Africa can both supply gas on the short term, Egypt, Algeria, but also can supply us with the hydrogen we need in the mid to long term. I mean, if we walk from crisis to crisis, from year to year, we will never solve this. We also need a long-term vision on where we want to go in the end. George, you said it is actually strange to think of Russia or of cutting off Russia forever, for completely. But in terms of natural gas, that's actually what we are going to do. And not only with Russia. Actually, it's what we're going to do with everything everyone in the world, because we are getting out of fossil fuels, not just from Russia, but from everybody.
On this point, I mean, can you give us a sense of the timeline? I mean, there's one thing to say, we want to get out of fossil fuel in 10 years, et cetera, et cetera, as the Green Deal was saying. There's quite another one saying we get out of it in the next 2-3 years. And, you know, coming back to Georg's point, suppose there was a change in, let's say, the political orientation of Russia, let's put it this way, in polite terms, I mean, will you really be able to do next year and say next year, well, we are not going to, let's say next year we have a different political regime in Russia, we're not going to use the cheap Russian gas and instead rely on whatever kind of constructions, expensive LNGs. I mean, given also that the industrial orientation, of course, of many of our countries is very much, and including the German one, of course, is very much still oriented on cheap gas to produce industrial outputs.
I fully agree, although it's hard to speculate about easing the relationship with Russia at the moment. But let's add for the sake of argument, try and do that for a moment. Yes, at a certain, as I said, our plan, RePowerEU, is not only Green Deal oriented. It's not only decarbonizing our energy supply. It's also about diversifying our gas supplies. Diversifying means having the flexibility to go in any direction. So back to Russia, if that is possible in the coming years, would be an option for the natural gas that we need. But meanwhile, at least one third, and at the end of this decade, more than two thirds of our gas plan is about decarbonization. It's about not needing natural gas anymore, whether it's from Russia or somewhere else. So indeed, what we did, and actually it's no rocket science, what we did is we put Fit for 55 on the table and looked at how much gas supply it replaces by decarbonizing our economy. And then we said, okay, let's shift that as much as we can forward and away from Russia, right, because of the current circumstances. But we didn't change the internal objectives or the intrinsic objectives of our plan, which is to decarbonize our economy and make ourselves independent from fossil fuels per se.
Okay, I know Georg has to leave. Georg, did you want to say one last word? Or
yeah, if I may, I'm very happy that the Commission kind of didn't throw out the decarbonization agenda in the face of this crisis and essentially tries to use it as a catalyst to move faster on that. And I'm sure that this is the right way to go, because I mean, now the crisis might also enable us to do things and bring them forward that we otherwise would not have been able to do. And I would actually call upon both national and European system to make use of this crisis to do things like building transmission lines that have not been possible or wind farms, things that we kind of really need more urgently now than ever, and where the political system was so sticky in the past that things became impossible to a degree that was not healthy in my view anymore. But that is one element. Another point that I would like to make at the end, and it's another call for action, sort of for trying to be so a bit polemic, but my feeling is that there's still a bit of a lack of sense of priority and urgency on the topic. I mean, it's a topic that we have been discussing now in energy circles and also on a high level of government for 2 months or so. But still, there is no 24/7 emergency group that is dealing with that. There is not really a pooling of the experts. The discussions that I'm participating in are happening in 20 different circles, and it is very is very unclear on how and where to inject knowledge. And there's so much expertise out there in the system. And there is so many technical challenges and difficulties in this thing. And we are, in my view, in an economic war. And it needs some sort of economic situation room, a war room here, to be able to say, okay, what do we need? We need this amount of LNG. That's this group that is going to look into that and talk with the industry to do that. There's another group that is looking into how can we get more electricity being produced without natural gas. And all those things, I mean, we can do that. And it does not necessarily mean market intervention at the initial stage. It just means bringing the data together. And I mean, today, I still don't know how much oil is flowing through the Druzhba pipeline. And the gas import tracker that we built at the time was one of the few tools that were available to see things happening. And I think the strength of Europe is that we have this huge amount of expertise in a very distributed way and functioning through a market. But maybe in this crisis situation, it would be very helpful to set up a sort of grouping that brings this expertise better together. Thank you.
Thanks, Georg, for a call for a crisis group. And I'm sure, Didrik, you see that as a welcome suggestion, and perhaps you can invite one of our experts into this group. I'm sure that would be very useful. Well,
we consider ourselves sort of the crisis group. At least, I mean, we are making that plan that George mentioned to be published in May, and the Repower EU that we did in March was the proposal, and now we are asked by Council, by member states, to turn that into a plan. Turning a proposal into a plan means putting real concrete maps on the table with, for instance, the interconnectors that we need to build in order to make this happen. That we look at every member state's plans for renewable energy. Many of them are part of the so-called recovery plans that all the member states have made in the context of Next Generation EU. And we're going to look at those plans and see where we can accelerate and increase the ambition of those plans. So really putting the bits and pieces together, including also indeed working on the LNG imports. And not to forget, we need to work on our industry, because we can import hydrogen as if there's no tomorrow. We can ramp up our renewable electricity production. We need to make our industry ready to use all that hydrogen and electricity. That requires real transformation of steel, chemical, fertilizer industry. The big fossil fuel consumers of today need to be the demandeurs for renewable electricity and hydrogen of tomorrow. Those three legs of the plan, LNG imports, ramping up our renewables, making our industry ready to receive all those renewables, those three legs are going to be developed in the next 7 weeks, to be published somewhere at the end of May.
Okay, we started a little bit late, and so I hope we can also run over a little bit, because there are actually huge amount of questions, huge interest, lots of people following us. And so if you allow, Didrik, I will just ask you a few questions, and perhaps you can just take note and respond in one go to a set of questions. And perhaps one point by Agata Loskot-Strachota is, EU member states which will phase out Russian oil gas quicker risk decreasing their competitive situation versus those who are more reluctant to do so. Any idea how to deal with that? Then we have a question. So that's one question on the relative competitiveness. Then we have one question by Nicolas Gaetan. Thoughts on how to increase interconnection between the Iberian Peninsula and the EU to use Spain's huge regasification capacities. And similarly, on the same venue, Gazzani from Bank of Italy is asking, on LNG, the European regasification spare capacity is about 37 billion cubic meters without Spain. So your estimate of 50, relies it on an increased regasification capacity still in 22? Perhaps we take those two for a first round.
All right. We're actually three, but
No, well, they are connected, the second
three. Yeah. No, on the relative competitiveness, that requires indeed a burden sharing agreement, as we discussed also with George in the call on having expanding the 2009 framework on solidarity of gas supplies to each other. I don't think, by the way, that the premise that a country that moves out of fossil fuels faster has a competitive disadvantage. I do think that the countries that did move out of fossil fuels faster have a competitive advantage at the moment. And that situation might not change in the next 10 years. That's exactly what needs to happen in the context of the Green Deal and Fit for 55. On the interconnection capacity, well, as I said, we are going to put a map on the table in May saying, hey, Europe, member states, if we really want to make this happen and we are serious, we have to make some interconnections that were taboo up to now. And that's going to be discussions with some quite some tense, there might be some quite some tense discussions, but we need to have them. We can't.
But why only in May? Why only in May? I mean, this, if we need the capacity for the next winter, I mean, we have to do it now.
No. The interconnectors, even if I would put them on the table right now, the interconnector won't be there for next winter. So this is for the multi-year approach, right. And we. It's not like that everything that we are too late for next winter is, well, we should forget about it. No, because there's winters after next winter. So that's for the interconnectors. But brings me to the other question on the regasification, the 37 billion cubic meters of spare capacity. Our calculations tell us that if we extrapolate what we did in January and February last year, or this year, so actually the last 2 months, we get ourselves to a 50 billion cubic meters extra LNG capacity, including the Spanish ones. I mean, they are going to be used for Spain and for Portugal. They also need extra gas. And for the rest of Europe, we can touch upon that 50 billion cubic meters. It's not going to be easy. And for the years after, we would be better off if we have more regasification capacity or more LNG terminals. And they are being built at the moment. Also, those are for, let's say, the years after next year, not for next winter.
So perhaps one last set of questions. I mean, we have a question here on, you know, basically emphasizing that the solutions you put forward are good on the medium to long term, but we have to fill the storages in the next 4 to 5 months, and it will cost a lot. What can EU countries concretely do, and what should they do so that we solve that problem? And connected to this, there is a question by someone from I think the chemical industry, and he's saying, well, prices for gas will stay at a very high level. Even if we get enough gas, the prices will be very high, causing much harm. What do we do about this? What do we do about the industry sectors that are really dependent on cheap gas? And perhaps I abuse and ask you, push you a little bit more on, you know, the question I asked initially, in which we didn't have time to discuss yet, which is about the revenues. I mean, so Putin does make a lot of revenues currently out of gas and oil sales. The full embargo is rejected, but isn't there a need to come at least with a solution where we actually tax away the profits or set up a price cap so that the rent that Putin receives on current sales actually goes down? Perhaps you can also comment on that point.
Yeah, It touches upon a pretty fundamental issue that also George raised several times in his interview. He says we are in an economic war. The truth is we are not, because we don't dare to be. That's the conclusion after a few European councils and NATO summits and G7 summits. Europe doesn't want to cut itself off Russian fossil fuels completely because it doesn't want to enter into an economic war. Given that circumstance, given that premise, we are working on getting ourselves as independent as possible, as quick as possible. But we're not in an economic war because we don't want to be, apparently. And that's, I'm not saying I agree with that fact, but it's a fact. On prices, I mean, on revenues for Putin, yes, he earns $500 million a day on our fossil fuel imports, and that's exactly why we should end them as soon as possible. I don't think a cap on the prices that we pay Russia will help a lot. At least I would love to try, but apparently Europe doesn't want to try because obviously it will risk a supply disruption overnight. If we call Moscow and say we're not going to pay more than 35 euros per megawatt hour, I don't think we will get any gas anymore. And it would be a very effective way of starting that economic war. On the question of on energy prices, actually, there is something strange happening at the moment. When we were in an energy crisis in the 70s, countries responded with actually the only sensible response that you can deliver in such a situation, which is rationing. Ration the use of fossil fuels because you have an energy crisis. So we saw the car-free Sundays and the likes. At the moment, many, if not all countries worldwide, but especially Europe, are responding by subsidizing energy. So in response to an energy crisis, we're reducing VAT, we're reducing excise duties, we're subsidizing the use of energy, which everybody will explain to you is the wrong response.
Exactly.
Let's face it, it's the wrong way around. And apparently we are rich enough, wealthy enough to do this. I'm not sure whether it's the best possible solution. I would like to get out of this situation as soon as we can, hence Fit for 55, hence Repower EU, to get ourselves out of this overdependency, out of this dilemma, because at the moment we have to draw a conclusion that countries are not able to respond in the best possible way. They are trying to keep the price down while the price is going up. Every economist can explain to you that the only answer to this energy crisis should be getting our demand down as soon as we can. And part of that is a story that nobody dares to tell out loud, dares to say out loud. So let me be the one that does it. Yes, energy will be much more expensive as of now. Yes, energy was way too cheap in the last 40 years. And we've profited from it. We have created an enormous wealth at the expense of planet Earth. And so we do realize right now at the expense of geopolitical imbalances. And both need to be repaired. And in order to repair them, we need to pay more for energy. And by the way, also for food. The two basic needs of life, food and energy, we have paid way too little for that in the last 40 years, and we need to restore that situation. Can't be done overnight because you create too much havoc and trouble in a society, so you need to take your time. But given the current situation, we have little time to do that.
Diederik, thank you so much. These were some very, very important and clear messages at the end. And I think I completely agree with your point that we need to really change our demand pattern rapidly, subsidizing and reducing the cost of energy in a situation of supply shortages is crazy. On the contrary, we need to restrain our demand, and we need to understand that energy and also, as you say, food is going to cost more. And that will change our societies. It will change our economic model. It will change also our economic structure, our export structure. We might export less industrial energy-intensive goods to the rest of the world than we do currently. So there are pretty fundamental changes that are happening. And I think what I can say now, only our time is over. You've been extremely clear, extremely generous with your time. I enjoyed the discussion a lot. And thank you so much for your being so clear and upfront, and especially at the end with some very clear messages. And thank you to our audience for listening and for asking so many questions. I could not ask all of them, but I think we got really a good sense where the thinking in the Commission currently is on this issue. So thank you, Diederik. Thank you to all of you for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.